Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I'm wondering if, like me, you two are finding it difficult to hear the daily testimonies of those who are appearing in the numerous royal commissions and daily court cases on child abuse. On the one hand, we're gratified that those who have had their innocence stolen by these predators are now having the chance to be heard. And on the other hand, heartbroken that it's taken so long. Are we learning from these lost lives, or is the conversation too difficult even to engage with? We're all uncomfortable with some of the forensic detail that's being revealed in the coverage of these cases, but where is that point where we transition from what journalists call the right to know to something far more gratuitous? If I'm honest, I too have found some of these cases so confronting I've turned the radio or TV off. What kind of world are our children growing up in? Today we're going to hear from two ladies on the front line of two very different aspects of the child abuse conversation. Shortly, the mum who dedicates her life to mobilising parents to push back against the early sexualisation of our kids. First though, Professor Frieda Briggs AO, who has dedicated her life to child advocacy and child protection. In fact, the professor was among the first in the world to ring the bell on child abuse. Professor, you're most welcome to Open House. Thank you for joining us. Your personal history of child advocacy goes back to when you were a primary school student in post-World War II London, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. And then at school, when I had the audacity to protest that the punishment didn't fit the crime, when for talking in class, when a prefect was supervising us, I was given the whole of the Lady of Shalott poem to learn.
At 15, you protested against sexual harassment in the workplace.
I know, again, I don't know how I dared do it, because as I said, I was not a confident child, but I knew that the chief engineer, I was responsible for checking orders, and the chief engineer used to come in and place orders, and he was using sex talk and being suggestive, and I went and complained about him to the welfare officer. And she checked out with my colleagues, and they agreed that this was happening, and the chief engineer was moved. Back then, it was probably a very unusual thing to do, but I knew it was wrong and reported him.
You left traditional industry and went into the police force. When did you become involved in child abuse cases?
When I was 20. As you said, my Methodist upbringing was very influential. You know, we used to get missionaries, and it were drummed into us that irrespective of how poor we were, and believe you me, this was during the war, and we were poor, but that there were always other people worse off than you, and you had to help them. It was, we were brainwashed in that direction. And of course, as a kid, I was on a youth committee that was providing activities for disadvantaged kids and all that sort of stuff.
You emigrated to Australia in the late 70s, early 80s, and quickly became the go-to person for issues of child protection based on your experience in the UK. Compare for us our understanding of child abuse then as compared to now.
Yeah, well, I was unusual because I started lecturing on child abuse back in 1970, and there were no textbooks then, so I realised somewhere down the track I was going to have to do the research and write the textbooks, and I'm on number 21 at the moment. When I came to Australia, I think I was, apart from medical personnel and specialists, I was the only one lecturing in child protection issues. And, of course, gradually we were getting books from America. But I was banging my head against a brick wall for years. When I came to South Australia, I wanted to put child protection, child abuse into teacher education here. And I was the dean, by the way, so I had a little bit of clout. Mm. But the committee said, child abuse doesn't happen in Australia. Or if it happens, it might happen in Sydney, but, you know, it doesn't happen in Adelaide.
Goodness.
And of course, later on, it became, well, it might happen in the northern suburbs, but it doesn't happen where we live. And therefore, it isn't an academic subject. Well, I was able to show by this time, this was 1981, that the Americans were already researching in this area. So I got my way, but not for long, because when university funding was reduced, my course was one of the first to be chopped, which happened elsewhere as well. It happened in Auckland.
Professor, you were one of the first to ring the bell on the cycle of abuse. That is, that those who are abused often become the abuser later in life.
Well, we are seeing this at the moment. In Sydney, an 8-year-old sexually abusing younger children and choosing children with disabilities. And in South Australia, particularly in independent schools where they don't have the access, you know, to the education department, are big problems, because one child who is likely to have been abused, either because they've experienced abuse directly or they've been exposed to so much pornography that it's affected them badly, they will act out what they have learned with younger children when the teachers are not watching, usually in school toilets or cubby houses. In this case, it was a cubby house. And because the school teachers are not trained adequately to know what to do, you know, they should be asking that child, who showed him how to play that game? Where did he learn? Where does he play? Instead of which, they reprimand them and they go underground, you know, using secrecy and threats, especially if they've learned this from an adult. And then it grows like topsy. And what yesterday I got 50 emails as a result of that program. The ABC has been swamped with parents who've experienced this, where the schools have ignored it, done nothing. And in some cases, the child has come home and then sexually abused a younger sibling.
Professor, to what extent then can we rewrite this moral language in children who have fallen prey to this kind of activity?
Well, my big worry is that we are paying a very, very heavy price for adults' rights to look at anything they want in terms of pornography on the internet, because some of this is coming from mobile phones and from the internet. Every time there is a mention of you know, trying to curb pornography on the internet, adults are up in arms. You know, how dare you suggest curbing our freedom? And that includes women as well as men, I might add. But they're just not considering what the long-term effects are. These children are learning about sexual behavior the wrong way. They're learning about relationships the wrong way. You know, what is it going to be like? It's going to increase. The problem is increasing in schools now. And it's not just here, it's internationally. We don't know how to handle it in schools. As I said, teachers are not trained. Social workers are not helping because they're not adequately trained either. They're not adequately trained to differentiate behaviour that constitutes normal sexual curiosity. When parents have gone to the police, they're not interested because this age group doesn't commit a crime, and so they don't get any help from police. They're not getting help from child protection services, and this is why they're coming to me, in the hope that I can come up with magic solutions.
Professor, you also believe that as institutions, we often focus all of our attention on the perpetrator of these abuses within schools, for instance, and often forget the victim.
Actually, the victim is often re-victimised because they usually leave the perpetrator in the school. The school cannot guarantee the safety of the victims. And so desperate parents then have to remove the victims from the school. Now, they've lost their friends. They often, if they live in a village, you know, up in the Adelaide Hills, for example, where you don't have another option for your school, you then resort to homeschooling, which affects the family enormously. Mum may have to give up work. The child loses his social contacts. So the victim is re-victimised.
Professor, I know there are no easy ways to tie a conversation like this up. This is a lifelong conversation. But what are the practical steps that, as listeners to this show around the country, we can take as parents, even just as observers?
As parents, it's difficult with five-year-olds, but there is a little book called Everyone's Got a Bottom that you can buy from Queensland Family Planning or Family Planning Queensland. And that's about $16 from a guess. You get it from the internet. And that's a good little book to teach children that parts of their body are private. And I insisted that they put in the mouth because they used to talk about touching, you know, good and bad touching. Well, that's useless because sexual touching doesn't necessarily feel bad. But children didn't see touching as relating to the mouth. They thought that touching only involved hands.
Okay.
So you need to make sure that they know that nobody's allowed to put any part of their body in your mouth. And that's a health thing.
Yeah.
Schools should be teaching child protection. I'm not up to date with New South Wales, which I presume you're from.
Yes.
But they've had a child protection program for schools since 1985, to my knowledge, because I was asked to help with the revision after the Wood Royal Commission. South Australia, we've got a beauty that's compulsory in schools. They need to be able to have the courage and the confidence to say, no, stop that, it's not allowed. And as I said, we need much better training for teachers, for social workers, for all the professionals whose work involves children, because you've got lawyers working with children who become judges. And a judge came to me not very long ago and said he was shocked to realise that he'd been dependent on the myths surrounding child abuse. He'd been on the bench for 30 years and is now horrified by some of the assumptions that he was making that were totally wrong.
Professor Freda Briggs, thank you for sharing your insights with us on child abuse this afternoon on Open House. Clearly, there is yet much to do in this area.
Thank you very much.
Melinda Tankard-Reist is a Canberra author, speaker, media commentator, blogger, advocate for women and girls, a proud mum and a friend of Open House around Australia. She's also world-renowned for her work on the objectification of women and the sexualisation of our girls in efforts to address violence against women. A co-founder of Collective Shout for a free world, a world free of sexploitation, Melinda is named in the Who's Who of Women Australia edition as well as the Global edition. Melinda Tankard-Reist, thanks so much for joining us on Open House Around Australia. Last month, the CEO of the Royal Commission into Sexual Abuse stepped down from her key role. You may have missed the news around the country, but in doing so, she urged the work of the Commission to continue. Jeanette Dines was credited as being the linchpin for the discovery of many of the stories that are before the Commission right now that perhaps have opened many of our eyes. Are you concerned at all about the impact of Ms. Dines' departure on the future of the Commission?
Well, I think there's a couple of concerns here. The first concern is why did she feel she couldn't continue? I feel there's an untold story there that it would be helpful to know. Has she been stymied? Has she been frustrated? Or has it just taken too much of a toll on her personally? And then secondly, yes, it would have been good just to have the one person at the helm from start to finish. We hope that the newly appointed head of the inquiry will continue the momentum and will show understanding and compassion for the victims. You know, I hope that victims won't drop out, you know, that they become fearful of the process or what, you know, why this has happened. That's a significant concern is, you know, will it affect their willingness to continue to give evidence and to testify as to what happened?
One of the largest hurdles to overcome at the commencement of this process must have been creating a space where people who had been victims felt okay coming forward to put air to what were shocking crimes.
Absolutely. Victims have to feel safe to be able to give evidence. And, you know, there's probably many more that just didn't feel safe or weren't up to being re-traumatised. Any retelling of the child sexual assault story is re-traumatising, you know, over and over again. And so, yes, victims do have to feel safe to be able to go public, to be able to speak out. And as I said, I just hope that this changeover won't cause some of them to think, well, you know, if she couldn't stay in the position, what does it mean for us?
Melinda, as you touched on the unspoken pressures at play on those who are leading these various investigations around the country, I couldn't help but think of the pressure that must be on you as you've immersed yourself in the sexualisation of our children and our families these many years.
Oh, look, there's no doubt that there is a cost for any of us who are working in this field. I've been working on these issues for many years, and probably the biggest toll that I paid was when I was researching my book on pornography, Big Porn Inc., Exposing the Harms of the Global Pornography Industry, I learned things through that process that I didn't know and that I still wish that I didn't know. There's definitely a soul cost to the work. One of the biggest things that disturbed me from that research was what we are doing to the healthy sexual development of our young people. I discovered that our children are being exposed to pornography, average age of 11. They're being exposed to torture porn, sadism porn, bondage, incest porn, rape porn, extreme violence against women, and they think this is normal, and then they're acting out sexually on other young people, what they are learning from pornography. And I just don't know what hope there is for our young people to be able to develop healthy sexual relationships. So, yeah, definitely that kind of work takes the trauma to a new level, yeah. Like secondary trauma.
Melinda, how are our kids coming to these images? Is it through accident on unguarded family computers or somewhere more insidious?
Oh, it's just too easy. Even if they're not seeing it on the home computer, they're seeing it on a friend's iPhone at school or at a friend's place after school. You know, I talk about the pornification of culture because pornographic themes, messages and imagery are everywhere. The fact is that our pornographers have taken deliberate steps to get children using pornography. They have created entire pornographic websites based on children's most popular cartoon characters. Dora the Explorer, Dorothy the Dinosaur, Atomic Betty, The Simpsons, for example, all have hardcore XXX porn sites named after them. They've also studied the common keystroke errors that children make when they type search terms into search engines, and they send them to porn websites based on the mistakes that the children make. So it's not a matter of if my child will see pornography, it's a matter of when. It's inevitable. And so we have to have conversations with our children at much earlier ages.
I know, Melinda, in your previous discussions with Open House in years gone by, you're a big proponent of us resisting the temptation to disengage with conversations like this at this point where it gets uncomfortable, and instead channel that revulsion into stopping the flood of sexualized images not only being directed at our families but at our kids specifically.
Look, we have had our collective heads in the sands. We haven't wanted to face up to the reality that pornography is really taking over the world. This is a $100 billion US a year industry. $35 billion of that is child pornography alone. At any one second, 750,000 people are viewing child pornography. So we have to face these realities, and it's because we have preferred to exempt ourselves from the debate, from lobbying and advocacy for tighter regulation, that things are as bad as they are. The porn industry is winning because many people who are good people don't want to get involved because it is a horrible issue. You know, a lot of people say to me, oh, we're so glad you're fighting on that front. But sometimes I feel it's a way to, you know, absolve themselves for not doing it. And this is not to make anyone feel bad. I mean, again, who really wants to get involved in this issue? It's horrible. But, you know, the future of our children is at stake here. The ability of our children to have healthy friendships, healthy sexual relationships in the future, to be able to stand, you know, long-term partnerships, family life, all of that is at stake. And so, you know, we have to get involved, sadly.
Melinda, as we protect our kids from these images, it's hard to escape the increasing propensity of news services to cover the various investigations and sex crimes against other children in forensic detail. At what point do we need to pull back on the way we are disclosing the nature of crimes and simply report that the crimes have taken place and that punishment is being handed out?
Look, there's a fine line here, and I haven't quite worked it out myself. I would say that, yes, there can be a voyeuristic interest in the minute details of the abuse. That's not helpful to anyone. It's certainly not helpful to the child. I would also say, though, that sometimes we need to know the horror to understand, to try to understand what it is like for the survivor, and to not minimise these crimes in the public mind. So it's trying to get that balance right, not doing it in a voyeuristic way, but doing it in a way where We should be horrified. We should be shocked and horrified and then do something about it. Now, I'd like to make a further point. We have a lot of focus on TV celebrities. We've had focus, rightly so, on the Daniel Morcombe case. We have the Royal Commission. However, we actually don't want to address what I call a pedophile culture. In this culture, you can buy child sex abuse dolls online that replicate children that are around the age of 8. Bookworld, Borders, which was formerly Borders, Amazon, Barnes & Noble sell hundreds and hundreds of incest-themed books, and all of that's legal. We allow all of that. So while on the one hand, you know, we're shocked and horrified at what some of these celebrities are doing, we're actually providing a driver for that kind of behaviour in mainstream popular culture.
But
it goes unaddressed.
If I play devil's advocate, and I'm not justifying that that stuff's legal and that I could purchase that now and not end up in court, I think is ludicrous. But up until this moment, there would be people who didn't even know this was happening. So in a way, how is it we've not just publicised the availability of this stuff in having this conversation?
Well, one of the reasons that Collective Shout for a World Free of Sexploitation started was to expose this material. And I know what you're saying, if we name it, are we promoting it? Well, if we don't name it, we're still promoting it, really, because we're not doing anything about it. So if we don't know what's happening, if we don't know how bad it is, there's no movement to action. So, you know, I do know what you're saying, but silence is acquiescence. And to be silent means that, you know, you're okay about it. The standard you walk past is the standard you set, and this is the standard that we have allowed for all of us.
What traction have you had to show that having this conversation is worthwhile, is worth the pain?
Definitely. Well, Collective Shout, we're less than 5 years old, and we name and shame advertisers, corporations and marketers who objectify women and sexualise girls to sell products and services. And we have had some significant victories. We have had victories against major corporations where we've forced them to withdraw advertising, billboards, clothing, to remove porn magazines from petrol stations. To take a few examples, our most recent victory was against Isuzu Ute, which had a competition for men to win a sex tour of Thailand.
Goodness.
5 hot nights in Bangkok. And this is a mainstream car company in Australia. And so we said, look, you're promoting sex trafficking, you're promoting the exploitation of vulnerable women in Thailand. And within 48 hours, that competition was stopped. We have campaigns running every day, all the time. We equip and empower people to take action. It's very difficult often to know how to navigate the complaints processes in this country because they're deliberately hard,
yeah.
So you give up. We make it easier. We describe the problem. We tell you the steps to take. And a lot of women write to me and say, as a result of your work, as a result of Collective Shout, I feel brave now. I didn't feel brave before because I thought maybe it was just me, maybe I was the only one to feel this way. And now I realise that there's thousands of others that feel the same way as well. So, yeah, it's about that grassroots protest action to try to bring about social transformation.
How do we engage our kids into turning away from the mobile phone that's shoved in front of their face by a mate at school?
Look, it needs a whole-of-community approach. It's too hard for parents on our own to protect our children from porn. So we need individual action, we need collective action, and we need our governments and regulatory bodies to act as well. My view with schools is that they need to have a zero tolerance approach. If porn is being shown in the schoolyard, this is an act of harassment of the children that don't want to see it, and it's, you know, bringing down the standard of the whole school. The kid needs to be warned and possibly suspended. There's a prior question is why kids have their phones at school in the first place. There should be just very limited times they're allowed to use them. You know, they have to make a call home or something. But, you know, they're a great distraction, let alone passing on and disseminating, you know, pornography in the schoolyard. So, as I said, it needs a whole of community approach because it's just too hard for parents on our own.
Melinda Tankard-Reist, thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Thanks so much for your interest. Thanks for having me on the program, Duane.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.